Chapter 52. Impossible means of bringing the establishment and herself into contempt, among which may be briefly enumerated her unexpectedly performing clashing military music on Mr. Chadband's head with plates, and afterwards crowning that gentleman with muffins, at which period of the entertainment Guster whispers Mr. Snagsby that he is wanted, and being wanted in the not to put too fine a point upon it in the shop, says Mr. Snagsby, rising, "Perhaps this good company will excuse me for half a minute." Mr. Snagsby descends and finds the two prentices intently contemplating a police constable, who holds a ragged boy by the arm. "Why, bless my heart," says Mr. Snagsby, "what's the matter?" "This boy," says the constable, "although he's repeatedly told to, won't move on. I'm always a moving on, sir," cries the boy, wiping away his grimy tears with his arm. "I've always been a moving, and a moving on, ever since I was born. Where can I possibly move to, sir? More nor I do move." "He won't move on," says the constable calmly, with a slight professional hitch of his neck involving its better settlement in his stiff stock, "although he has been repeatedly cautioned, and therefore I am obliged to take him into custody. He's as obstinate a young gonoff as I know. He won't move on." "Oh, my eye! Where can I move to?" cries the boy, clutching quite desperately at his hair, and beating his bare feet upon the floor of Mr. Snagsby's passage. "Don't you come none of that, or I shall make less short work of you," says the constable, giving him a passionless shake. "My instructions are that you are to move on. I have told you so 500 times. "But where?" cries the boy. "Well, really, constable, you know," says Mr. Snagsby wistfully, and coughing behind his hand his cough of great perplexity and doubt, "really, that does seem a question." "Where, you know?" "My instructions don't go to that," replies the constable. "My instructions are that this boy is to move on. Do you hear, Joe? It is nothing to you, or to anyone else, that the great lights of the parliamentary sky have failed for some few years in this business, to set you the example of moving on. The one grand recipe remains for you, the profound philosophical prescription, the be-all and the end-all of your strange existence upon earth. Move on. You are by no means to move off, Joe, for the great lights can't at all agree about that. Move on." Mr. Snagsby says nothing to this effect, says nothing at all indeed, but coughs his forlornest cough, expressive of no thoroughfare in any direction. By this time Mr. and Mrs. Chadband and Mrs. Snagsby, hearing the altercation, have appeared upon the stairs. Guster having never left the end of the passage, the whole household are assembled. "The simple question is, sir," says the constable, "whether you know this boy." "He says you do." Mrs. Snagsby, from her elevation, instantly cries out, "No, he don't." "My little woman," says Mr. Snagsby, looking up the staircase. "My love, permit me. Pray have a moment's patience, my dear. I do know something of this lad, and in what I know of him, I can't say that there's any harm. Perhaps on the contrary, constable." To whom the law stationer relates his joyful and woeful experience, suppressing the half-crown fact. "Well," says the constable, "so far, it seems, he had grounds for what he said. When I took him into custody up in Holborn, he said you knew him. Upon that, a young man who was in the crowd said he was acquainted with you, and you were a respectable housekeeper, and if I'd call and make the inquiry, he'd appear. The young man don't seem inclined to keep his word, but oh, here is the young man." Enter Mr. Guppy, who nods to Mr. Snagsby and touches his hat with the chivalry of clerkship to the ladies on the stairs. "I was strolling away from the office just now, when I found this row going on," says Mr. Guppy to the law stationer, "and as your name was mentioned, I thought it was right the thing should be looked into." "It was very good-natured of you, sir," says Mr. Snagsby, "and I am obliged to you. and Mr. Snagsby again relates his experience, again suppressing the half-crown fact. "Now, I know where you live," says the constable then, to Joe. "You live down in Tom All Alone's. That's a nice innocent place to live in, ain't it?" "I can't go and live in no nicer place, sir," replies Joe. "They wouldn't have nothing to say to me if I was to go to a nice innocent place fur to live. Who'd go and let a nice innocent lodging to such a reglar one as me?" "You are very poor, ain't you?" says the constable. "Yes, I am indeed, sir, worry poor in general," replies Joe. "I leave you to judge now." "I shook these two half-crowns out of him," says the constable, producing them to the company, and only putting my hand upon him. "They're what's left, Mr. Snagsby," says Joe, "out of a sovereign as was give me by a lady in a will as said she was a servant, and as come to my crossing one night, and asked to be shout this here house, and the house what him as you give the written to died at, and the barren ground what he's buried in. She says to me, she says, are you the boy at the inquich? ?" she says. I says yes, I says. She says to me, she says, can you show me all them places? ?" I says yes, I can, I says. And she says to me, do it, and I done it, and she give me a sovereign and hooked it. And I ain't had much of the sovereign neither, says Joe, with dirty tears, for I had to pay 5 bob, down in Tom All Alone's, afore they'd square it fur to give me change, and then a young man he thieved another 5, while I was asleep, and another boy he thieved 9 pence, and the landlord he stood drains round with a lot more on it. You don't expect anybody to believe this, about the lady and the sovereign, do you? Says the constable, eyeing him aside with ineffable disdain. I don't know as I do, sir, replies Joe. I don't expect nothing at all, sir, much, but that's the true history on it. You see what he is, the constable observes to the audience. Well, Mr. Snagsby, if I don't lock him up this time, will you engage for his moving on? No, cries Mrs. Snagsby from the stairs. My little woman, pleads her husband. Constable, I have no doubt he'll move on. You know you really must do it, says Mr. Snagsby. I'm every ways agreeable, sir, says the hapless Joe. Do it then, observes the constable. You know what you have got to do. Do it. And recollect you won't get off so easy next time. Catch hold of your money. Now, the sooner you're 5 mile off, the better for all parties. With this farewell hint and pointing generally to the setting sun as a likely place to move on to, the constable bids his auditors good afternoon, and makes the echoes of Cook's Court perform slow music for him as he walks away on the shady side, carrying his iron-bound hat in his hand for a little ventilation. Now, Joe's improbable story concerning the lady and the sovereign has awakened more or less the curiosity of all the company. Mr. Guppy, who has an inquiring mind in matters of evidence, and who has been suffering severely from the lassitude of the long vacation, takes that interest in the case that he enters on a regular cross-examination of the witness, which is found so interesting by the ladies that Mrs. Snagsby politely invites him to step upstairs and drink a cup of tea, if he will excuse the disarranged state of the tea table, consequent on their previous exertions. Mr. Guppy yielding his assent to this proposal, Joe is requested to follow into the drawing room doorway, where Mr. Guppy takes him in hand as a witness, patting him into this shape, that shape, and the other shape like a butterman dealing with so much butter, and worrying him according to the best models. Nor is the examination unlike many such model displays, both in respect of its eliciting nothing, and of its being lengthy, for Mr. Guppy is sensible of his talent, and Mrs. Snagsby feels, not only that it gratifies her inquisitive disposition, but that it lifts her husband's establishment higher up in the law. During the progress of this keen encounter, the vessel Chadband, being merely engaged in the oil trade, gets aground and waits to be floated off. Well, says Mr. Guppy, Either this boy sticks to it like cobbler's wax, or there is something out of the common here that beats anything that ever came into my way at Kenjan Carboys. Mrs. Chadband whispers Mrs. Snagsby, who exclaims, "You don't say so." "For years," replied Mrs. Chadband. "Has known Kenjan Carboy's office for years," Mrs. Snagsby triumphantly explains to Mr. Guppy. "Mrs. Chadband, this gentleman's wife, Reverend Mr. Chadband."
"Oh, indeed,"
says Mr. Guppy. "Before I married my present husband," says Mrs. Chadband. "Was you a party in anything, ma'am?" says Mr. Guppy, transferring his cross-examination.
"No.
Not a party in anything, ma'am," says Mr. Guppy. Mrs. Chadband shakes her head. "Perhaps you were acquainted with somebody who was a party in something, ma'am," says Mr. Guppy, who likes nothing better than to model his conversation on forensic principles. "Not exactly that either," replies Mrs. Chadband, humoring the joke with a heart-favored smile. "Not exactly that either," repeats Mr. Guppy. "Very good. Pray, ma'am, was it a lady of your acquaintance who had some transactions, we will not at present say what transactions, with Kenjan Carboy's office, or was it a gentleman of your acquaintance? Take time, ma'am. We shall come to it presently. Man or woman, ma'am?" "Neither," says Mrs. Chadband as before.
"Oh,
a child," says Mr. Guppy, throwing on the admiring Mrs. Snagsby the regular acute professional eye which is thrown on British jurymen. "Now, ma'am, perhaps you will have the kindness to tell us what child." "You have got it at last, sir," says Mrs. Chadband with another heart-favored smile. "Well, sir, it was before your time, most likely, judging from your appearance. I was left in charge of a child named Esther Summerson, who was put out in life by Messrs. Kenjan Carboy."
"Miss Summerson, ma'am,"
cries Mr. Guppy, excited. "I call her Esther Summerson," says Mrs. Chadband with austerity. "There was no missing of the girl in my time. It was Esther. Esther, do this. Esther, do that. Apostrophe, and she was made to do it." "My dear ma'am," returns Mr. Guppy, moving across the small apartment, "the humble individual who now addresses you received that young lady in London when she first came here from the establishment to which you have alluded. Allow me to have the pleasure of taking you by the hand." Mr. Chadband, at last seeing his opportunity, makes his accustomed signal and rises with a smoking head, which he dabs with his pocket handkerchief. Mrs. Snagsby whispers, "Hush." "My friends," says Chadband, "we have partaken in moderation, which was certainly not the case so far as he was concerned, of the comforts which have been provided for us. May this house live upon the fatness of the land. May corn and wine be plentiful there. May it grow, may it thrive, may it prosper, may it advance, may it proceed, may it press forward. But, my friends, have we partaken of anything else?"
"We have."
"My friends, of what else have we partaken?"
"Of spiritual profit?"
"Yes."
"From whence have we derived that spiritual profit?"
"My young friend, stand forth." Joe, thus apostrophized, gives a slouch backward, and another slouch forward, and another slouch to each side, and confronts the eloquent Chadband with evident doubts of his intentions.
"My young friend," says Chadband, "you are to us a pearl, you are to us a diamond, you are to us a gem, you are to us a jewel.
And why, my young friend?"
"I don't know," replies Joe. "I don't know nothing."
"My young friend," says Chadband, "it is because you know nothing that you are to us a gem and jewel. For what are you, my young friend? Are you a beast of the field?
No.
A bird of the air?
No.
A fish of the sea or river?
No.
You are a human boy, my young friend.
A human boy.
Oh, glorious to be a human boy.
And why glorious, my young friend?
Because you are capable of receiving the lessons of wisdom, because you are capable of profiting by this discourse which I now deliver for your good,
because you are not a stick, or a staff, or a stock, or a stone, or a post, or a pillar. O running stream of sparkling joy, to be a soaring human boy. And do you cool yourself in that stream now, my young friend? No. Why do you not cool yourself in that stream now? Because you are in a state of darkness, because you are in a state of obscurity, because you are in a state of sinfulness, because you are in a state of bondage. My young friend, what is bondage? Let us, in a spirit of love, inquire. At this threatening stage of the discourse, Joe, who seems to have been gradually going out of his mind, smears his right arm over his face, and gives a terrible yawn. Mrs. Snagsby indignantly expresses her belief that he is a limb of the archfiend. My friends, says Mr. Chadband with his persecuted chin folding itself into its fat smile again as he looks round, it is right that I should be humbled, it is right that I should be tried, it is right that I should be mortified, it is right that I should be corrected. I stumbled, on Sabbath last, when I thought with pride of my 3 hours improving. The account is now favorably. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.